the traffic. The Irish are once again leaving Ireland, along with hordes of migrant workers. In late 2006, the unemployment rate stood at a bit more than 4%. Now it's 14%, and climbing toward rates not experienced since the mid-1980s. Just a few years ago, Ireland was able to borrow money more cheaply than Germany. Now, if it can borrow at all, it will be charged interest rates 6% higher than Germany, another echo of a distant past. The Irish budget deficit, in 2007 the country had a budget surplus, is now 32% of its GDP, the highest by far in the history of the Eurozone. Professional credit analyst firms now judge Ireland the third most likely country in the world to default. Not quite as risky for the global investor as Venezuela, perhaps, but riskier than Iraq. Distinctly third world in any case. Yet when I arrived, Irish politics had a frozen-in-time quality. In Iceland, the business-friendly Conservative Party had been quickly tossed out of power, and the women had booted the alpha males out of the banks and government. In Greece, the corrupt, business-friendly, every-Greek-for-himself Conservative Party was also given the heave-ho, and the new government is attempting to create a sense of collective purpose, or at any rate persuade the citizens to quit cheating on their taxes. The new Greek prime minister is not merely upstanding, but barely Greek. Ireland was the first European country to watch its entire banking system fail, and yet its business-friendly Conservative Party, Fianna Fáil, remained in office up until February 2011. There's no Tea Party movement, no Glenn Beck, no serious protests of any kind. The only obvious change in the country's politics has been the role played by foreigners. The new bank regulator, an Englishman, came from Bermuda. The Irish government and Irish banks are crawling with American investment bankers and Australian management consultants and faceless Euro officials referred to inside the Department of Finance simply as the Germans. Walk the streets at night, and through restaurant windows you see important-looking men in suits, dining alone, studying important-looking papers. In some new and strange way, Dublin was now an occupied city. Hanoi, circa 1950. The problem with Ireland is that you're not allowed to work with Irish people anymore, an Irish property developer told me. He was finding it difficult to escape hundreds of millions of euros in debt he would never be able to repay. Ireland's regress is especially unsettling because of the questions it raises about Ireland's former progress. Even now, no one is quite sure why the Irish did so well for themselves in the first place. Between 1845 and 1852, the country experienced the single greatest loss of population in world history. In a nation of 8 million, 1.5 million people left. Another million Irish people starved to death or died from the effects of hunger. Inside of a decade, the nation went from being among the most densely populated in Europe to one of the least. The founding of the Irish state in 1922 might have offered some economic hope. They now had their own central bank, their own economic policies. But right up until the end of the 1980s, the Irish had failed to do what economists expected them to do, catch up with their neighbors' standard of living. As recently as the 1980s, 1 million Irish people, in a nation of a mere 3.2 million, lived below the poverty line. What has occurred in Ireland since then is without precedent in economic history. By the start of the new millennium, the Irish poverty rate was under 6%, and Ireland was the second richest country in the world, according to the Bank of Ireland. How did that happen? A bright young Irishman who got himself hired by Bear Stearns in the late 1990s and went off to New York or London for 5 years, returned feeling poor. For the better part of the past decade, there's been quicker money to be made in Irish real estate than in American investment banking. How did that happen? For the first time in history, people and money longed to get into Ireland rather than out of it. The most dramatic case in point are the polls. The Polish government keeps no official statistics on the movement of its workforce, but its foreign ministry guesstimates that since their admission to the European Union, 1 million Poles have left Poland to work elsewhere, and that at the peak in 2006, 250,000 of them were in Ireland. For the United States to achieve a proportionally distortive demographic effect, it would need to hand green cards to 17.5 million Mexicans. How did any of this happen? There are many theories. The elimination of trade barriers, the decision to grant free public higher education, a low corporate tax rate introduced in the 1980s, which turned Ireland into a tax haven for foreign corporations. Maybe the most intriguing was offered by a pair of demographers at Harvard, David E. Bloom and David Canning, in a 2003 paper called Contraception and the Celtic Tiger. Bloom and Canning argued that a major cause of the Irish boom was a dramatic increase in the ratio of working age to non-working age Irishmen brought about by a crash in the Irish birth rate. This, in turn, had been mainly driven by Ireland's decision in 1979 to legalize birth control. That is, there was an inverse correlation between a nation's fidelity to the Vatican's edicts and its ability to climb out of poverty. Out of the slow death of the Irish Catholic Church arose an economic miracle. The Harvard demographers admitted their theory explained only part of what had happened in Ireland, and at the bottom of the success of the Irish there remains even now some mystery. It appeared like a miraculous beast materializing in a forest clearing, writes the preeminent Irish historian R.F. Foster, and economists are still not entirely sure why. Not knowing why they were so suddenly so successful, the Irish can perhaps be forgiven for not knowing exactly how successful they were meant to be. They'd gone from being abnormally poor to being abnormally rich without pausing to experience normality. When in the early 2000s the financial markets began to offer virtually unlimited credit to all comers, when nations were led into the dark room with a pile of money and asked what would they like to do with it, the Irish were already in a peculiarly vulnerable state of mind. They'd spent the better part of a decade under something very like a magic spell. A few months after the spell was broken, the short-term parking lot attendants at Dublin Airport noticed that their daily take had fallen. The lot appeared full. They couldn't understand it. Then they noticed the cars never changed. They phoned the Dublin police, who in turn traced the cars to Polish construction workers, who had bought them with money borrowed from the big Irish banks. The migrant workers had ditched the cars and gone home. A few months later, the Bank of Ireland sent 3 collectors to Poland to see what they could get back, but they had no luck. The Poles were untraceable. But for their cars in the short-term parking lot, they might never have existed. Morgan Kelly is a professor of economics at University College Dublin, but he did not, until recently, view it as his business to think much about the economy under his nose. He had written a handful of highly regarded academic papers on topics regarded as abstruse even by academic economists: the economic impact of the Little Ice Age. "I only stumbled on this catastrophe by accident," he says. "I had never been interested in the Irish economy. The Irish economy is tiny and boring." Kelly saw house prices rising madly and heard young men in Irish finance, to whom he had recently taught economics, try to explain why the boom didn't trouble them. And the sight and sound of them troubled him. Around the middle of 2006, all these former students of ours working for the banks started to appear on TV, he says. They were now all bank economists, and they were nice guys and all that, and they were all saying the same thing. We're going to have a soft landing. The statement struck him as absurd on the face of it. Real estate bubbles never end with soft landings. A bubble is inflated by nothing firmer than people's expectations. The moment people cease to believe that house prices will rise forever, they will notice what a terrible long-term investment real estate has become and flee the market, and the market will crash. It was in the nature of real estate booms to end with crashes, just as it was perhaps in Morgan Kelly's nature to assume that if his former students were cast on Irish TV playing the financial experts, something was amiss. "I just started Googling things," he said. Googling things, Kelly learned that more than a fifth of the Irish workforce was now employed building houses. The Irish construction industry had swollen to become nearly a quarter of Irish GDP, compared to less than 10% or so in a normal economy. And Ireland was building half as many new houses a year as the United Kingdom, which had 15 times as many people to house. He learned that since 1994, the average price for a Dublin home had risen more than 500%. In parts of Dublin, rents had fallen to less than 1% of the purchase price. That is, you could rent a $1 million home for less than $833 a month. The investment returns on Irish land were ridiculously low. It made no sense for capital to flow into Ireland to develop more of it. Irish home prices implied an economic growth rate that would leave Ireland, in 25 years, three times as rich as the United States. A price-earnings ratio above Google's, as Kelly put it. Where would this growth come from? Since 2000, Irish exports had stalled, and the economy had become consumed with building houses and offices and hotels. Competitiveness didn't matter, says Kelly. From now on, we were going to get rich building houses for each other. The endless flow of cheap foreign money had teased a new trait out of a nation. We are sort of a hard, pessimistic people, says Kelly. We don't look on the bright side. Yet since the year 2000, a lot of people had behaved as if each day would be sunnier than the last. The Irish had discovered optimism. Their real estate boom had the flavor of a family lie. It was sustainable so long as it went unquestioned, and it went unquestioned so long as it appeared sustainable. After all, once the value of Irish real estate came untethered from rents, there was no value for it that couldn't be justified. The 35 million euros Irish entrepreneur Dennis O'Brien paid for the impressive manor house on Dublin's Shrewsbury Road sounded like a lot until the real estate developer Sean Dunn's wife paid 58 million euros for the 4,000 square foot fixer-upper just down the street. But the minute you compared the rise in prices to real estate booms elsewhere and at other times, you re-anchored the conversation. You biffed the narrative. The comparisons that sprung first to Morgan Kelly's mind were with the housing bubbles in the Netherlands in the 1970s, after natural gas was discovered in Holland, and Finland in the 1980s, after oil was found off its coast. But it almost didn't matter which examples he picked. The mere idea that Ireland was not sui generis was the panic-making thought. There is an iron law of house prices, he wrote. The more house prices rise relative to income and rents, the more they will subsequently fall. The problem for Kelly, once he had these thoughts, was what to do with them. This isn't my day job, he says. I was working on medieval population theory. By the time I got to him, Kelly had angered and alienated the entire Irish business and political establishment, but he was himself neither angry nor alienated, nor even especially public. He's not the pundit type. He works in an office built when Irish higher education was conducted on linoleum floors beneath fluorescent lights, surrounded by metal bookshelves and generally felt more like a manufacturing enterprise than a prep school for real estate and finance, and likes it. He's puckish, unrehearsed, and apparently, though in Ireland one wants to be careful about using this word, sane. Though not exactly self-denying, he's clearly more comfortable talking and thinking about subjects other than himself. He spent years in graduate school and collected a doctorate from Yale, and yet somehow retained an almost childlike curiosity. "I was in this position, sort of being a passenger on this ship," he says, "and you see a big iceberg. And so you go and ask the captain, 'Is that an iceberg?'" His warning to his ship's captain took the form of his first ever newspaper article. Its bottom line: it is not implausible that Irish real estate prices could fall relative to income by 40% to 50%. At the top of the market, he guessed prices might fall by a staggering 66%. He sent his first piece to the small circulation Irish Times. "It was a whim," he says. "I'm not even sure that I believed what I was saying at the time. My position has always been, you can't predict the future." As it happened, Kelly had predicted the future with uncanny accuracy. But to believe what he was saying, you had to accept that Ireland was not some weird exception in human financial history. "It had no impact," Kelly says. The response was general amusement. It was, "What will these crazy eggheads come up with next?" sort of stuff. What the crazy egghead came up with next was the obvious link between Irish real estate prices and Irish banks. After all, the vast majority of the construction was being funded by Irish banks. If the real estate market collapsed, those banks would be on the hook for the losses. "I eventually figured out what was going on," says Kelly. "The average value and number of new mortgages peaked in summer 2006, but lending standards were clearly falling after this. The banks continued to make worse loans, but the people borrowing the money to buy houses were growing wary. What was happening," says Kelly, "is that a lot of people were getting cold feet. The consequences for Irish banks and the economy of the inevitable shift in market sentiment would be catastrophic. The banks' losses would lead them to slash their lending to actually useful businesses. Irish citizens in hock to their banks would cease to spend. And perhaps worst of all, new construction, on which the entire economy was now premised, would cease." Kelly wrote his second newspaper article, more or less predicting the collapse of the Irish banks. He pointed out that in the last decade, the Irish banks and economy had fundamentally changed. In 1997, the Irish banks were funded entirely by Irish deposits. By 2005, they were getting most of their money from abroad. The small German savers who ultimately supplied the Irish banks with deposits to re-lend in Ireland could take their money back with the click of a computer mouse. Since 2000, lending to construction and real estate had risen from 8% of Irish bank lending, the European norm, to 28%. 100 billion euros, or basically the sum total of all Irish bank deposits, had been handed over to Irish commercial property developers. By 2007, Irish banks were lending 40% more to property developers alone than they had to the entire Irish population 7 years earlier. You probably think that the fact that Irish banks have given speculators 100 billion euro to gamble with, safe in the knowledge that the taxpayers will cover most losses, is a cause for concern to the Irish Central Bank, Kelly wrote. But you would be quite wrong. This time, Kelly sent his piece to a newspaper with a far bigger circulation, the Irish Independent. The Independent's editor wrote back to say he found the article offensive and wouldn't publish it. Kelly next turned to the Sunday Business Post, but the editor just sat on the piece. The journalists were following the banker's lead and conflating a positive outlook on real estate prices with a love of country and a commitment to Team Ireland. They'd all use this same phrase, "You're either for us or against us," says a prominent Irish bank analyst in Dublin. Kelly finally went back to the Irish Times, which ran his piece in September 2007. A brief end to Kelly's way of thinking, pointless controversy ensued. The public relations guy at University College Dublin called the head of the Department of Economics and asked him to find someone to write a learned attack on Kelly's piece. The department head refused. A senior executive at Anglo-Irish Bank, Matt Moran, called to holler at him. He went on about how the real estate developers who are borrowing from us are so incredibly rich they are only borrowing from us as a favor. He wanted to argue, but we ended up having lunch. This is Ireland, after all. Kelly also received a flurry of worried-sounding messages from financial people in London, but of these he was dismissive. "I get the impression there's this pool of analysts in the financial markets who spend all day sending scary emails to each other." He never found out how much force his little newspaper piece exerted on the minds of people who mattered. It wasn't until almost exactly 1 year later, on September 29, 2008, that Morgan Kelly became the startled object of popular interest. The stocks of the three main Irish banks, Anglo-Irish, AIB, and Bank of Ireland, had fallen by between a fifth and a half in a single trading session, and a run on Irish bank deposits had started. The Irish government was about to guarantee all the obligations of the six biggest Irish banks. The most plausible explanation for all of this was Morgan Kelly's narrative, that the Irish economy had become a giant Ponzi scheme and the country was effectively bankrupt. But it was so starkly at odds with the story peddled by Irish government officials and senior Irish bankers that the banks merely had a liquidity problem and that Anglo-Irish was fundamentally sound that the two could not be reconciled. The government had a report newly thrown together by Merrill Lynch, which declared that all of the Irish banks are profitable and well capitalized. The difference between the official line and Kelly's was too vast to be split. You believed either one or the other. And up until September 2008, who was going to believe this guy holed up in his office, wasting his life writing about the effects of the little ice age on the English population? "I went on TV," says Kelly. "I'll never do it again." Kelly's colleagues in the University College Economics Department watched his transformation from serious academic to amusing crackpot to disturbingly prescient guru with interest. One was Colm McCarthy, who, in the Irish recession of the late 1980s, played a high-profile role in slashing government spending, and so had experienced the intersection of finance and public opinion. In McCarthy's view, the dominant narrative inside the head of the average Irish citizen, and his receptiveness to the story Kelly was telling, changed at roughly 10 o'clock in the evening on October 2, 2008. On that night, Ireland's bank regulator, a lifelong central bank bureaucrat in his 60s named Patrick Neary, came live on national television to be interviewed. The interviewer sounded as if he had just finished reading the collected works of Morgan Kelly. The Irish bank regulator, for his part, looked as if he had been dragged from a hole into which he badly wanted to return. He wore an insecure little mustache, stammered rote answers to questions he had not been asked, and ignored the ones he had been asked. A banking system is an act of faith. It survives only for as long as people believe it will. 2 weeks earlier, the collapse of Lehman Brothers had cast doubts on banks everywhere. Ireland's banks had not been managed to withstand doubt. They had been managed to exploit blind faith. Now the Irish people finally caught a glimpse of the guy meant to be safeguarding them. The crazy uncle had been sprung from the family cellar. Here he was, on their televisions, insisting that the Irish bank's problems had nothing whatsoever to do with the loans they'd made. When anyone with eyes could see, in the vacant skyscrapers and empty housing estates around them, evidence of bank loans that were not merely bad, but insane. What happened was that everyone in Ireland had the idea that somewhere in Ireland there was a little, wise, old man who was in charge of the money. And this was the first time they'd ever seen this little man, says McCarthy. And then they saw him and said, "Who the fuck was that? Is that the fucking guy who is in charge of the money?" That's when everyone panicked. On the morning of the day the Irish government planned to unveil a brutal new budget, I took my seat in the visitors' gallery of the Irish Parliament. Beside me sat an aide to Joan Burton, who is the Labour Party's financial spokesperson, was at the time a fair bet to become Ireland's next Minister of Finance, the unnatural heir to an unholy mess. Down on the floor, the seats are mostly empty, but a handful of politicians, Burton included, discuss what they have been discussing without intermission for the past 2 years, the nation's financial crisis. The first thing you notice when you watch the Irish Parliament at work is that the politicians say everything twice, once in English and once in Gaelic. As there is no one in Ireland who does not speak English, and a vast majority who do not speak Gaelic, this comes across as a forced gesture that wastes a great deal of time. I ask several Irish politicians if they speak Gaelic, and all offer the same uneasy look and hedgy reply, "Enough to get by." The politicians in Ireland speak Gaelic the way the Real Housewives of Orange County speak French. To ask why bother to speak it at all is, of course, to miss the point. Everywhere you turn, you see both emulation of the English and a desire, sometimes desperate, for distinction. The Irish insistence on their Irishness, their conceit that they are more devoted to their homeland than the typical citizen of the world, has an element of bluster about it from top to bottom. At the top are the many very rich Irish people who emit noisy, patriotic sounds, but arrange officially to live elsewhere so they don't have to pay tax in Ireland. At the bottom, the waves of emigration that define Irish history. The Irish people and their country are like lovers whose passion is heightened by their suspicion that they will probably wind up leaving each other. Their loud patriotism is a cargo ship for their doubt. On this day, in addition to awaiting word on the budget, the Dáil, as the Irish call their House of Representatives, had before it what should have been a controversial piece of business, to vote on whether to call elections to fill its 4 empty seats. The ruling party, Fianna Fáil, held a slim majority of 2 seats, and because they are universally believed to have created a financial catastrophe, an approval rating of 15%. If the elections were held immediately, they'd have been tossed from power, in itself a radical idea, as they have more or less ruled Ireland since its founding as an independent state in 1922. Yet they successfully resisted the call to fill the empty seats right up until they were tossed from power in February 2011. A bell rings for a vote, and Irish politicians stream in. A few minutes before the vote, the doors to their chamber will be closed and guarded. A politician who is late is a politician who cannot vote. A glass barrier separates the visitors' gallery and the floor. I asked my tour guide about it. "It's not to stop people from throwing things at their government," she says, then goes on to explain. Some years ago, an Irish politician came late after the doors had been locked. He ran up to the visitors' gallery, jumped down from it into the press gallery 10 feet below, and from there rappelled down the wall to the floor. They allowed the vote, but put up the glass barrier. They disapproved of the loophole, but rewarded the guy with the wit to exploit it. This, she claims, is very Irish. The first to take his seat is Bertie Ahern, the Prime Minister from June 1997 until May 2008, and political perp number one. Ahern is known both for a native shrewdness and for saying lots of spectacularly dumb-sounding things that are fun to quote. Tony Blair has credited him with a kind of genius in how he brokered the Northern Ireland peace negotiations. On the other hand, seeking to explain the financial crisis, he actually said Lehman's was a world investment bank. They had testicles everywhere. Ahern spent his last days in office denying he had accepted bribes from property developers, at least in part because so much of what he did in office seemed justified only if he were being paid by property developers to do it. But Bertie Ahern, too, obviously believed in the miracle of Irish real estate. After Morgan Kelly published his article predicting the collapse of the Irish banks, for instance, Ahern famously responded to a question about it by saying, "Sitting on the sidelines, cribbing and moaning is a lost opportunity. I don't know how people who engage in that don't commit suicide." Now, Ahern is just another Irish backbencher, with a hangdog slouch and a face mottled by broken capillaries. To fill the empty hours, he'd taken a second job writing a sports column for the Rupert Murdoch Sunday tabloid News of the World, which just might be the least respectable job in global journalism. Ahern's star, such as it was, has fallen. When the Irish land boom flipped from miracle to catastrophe, a lot of important people's status, along with perhaps their sense of themselves, flipped with it. An Irish stockbroker has told me that many of the former bankers, some of whom he counts as clients, actually physically look different. He'd just seen the former CEO of Allied Irish Banks, Eugene Sheehy, in a restaurant, being heckled by other diners. Sheehy once had been a smooth, self-possessed character whose authority was beyond question. "If you saw the guy now," says my stockbroker friend, "you'd buy him a cup of tea." The Irish real estate bubble was different from the American version in many ways. It wasn't disguised, for a start. It didn't require a lot of complicated financial engineering beyond the understanding of mere mortals. It also wasn't as cynical. There aren't a lot of Irish financiers or real estate people who have emerged with a future. In America, the banks went down, but the big shots in them still got rich. In Ireland, the big shots went down with the banks. Sean Fitzpatrick, a working-class kid turned banker who built Anglo-Irish Bank more or less from scratch, is widely viewed as the chief architect of Ireland's misfortune. Today he is not merely bankrupt but unable to show his face in public. Mention his name, and people with no interest in banking will tell you with disgust how he disguised millions of euros of loans made to himself by his own bank. What they don't mention is what he did with the money. Invested it in Anglo-Irish bonds. When the bank failed, Fitzpatrick was listed among its creditors, having, in April 2008, purchased 5 million euros of Anglo-Irish subordinated floating-rate notes. The top executives of all three banks operated in a similar spirit. They bought shares in their own companies right up to the moment of collapse and continued to pay dividends as if they had capital to burn. Virtually all of the big Irish property developers who behave recklessly signed personal guarantees for their loans. It's widely assumed that they must be hiding big piles of money somewhere, but the evidence thus far suggests that they are not. The Irish Property Council has counted 29 suicides by property developers since the crash, in a country where suicide often goes unreported and undercounted. I said to all the guys, "Always take money off the table." Not many of them took money off the table, says Dermot Desmond, an Irish billionaire who made his fortune from software in the early 1990s and so counts as old money. The Irish nouveau riche may have created a Ponzi scheme, but it was a Ponzi scheme in which they themselves believed. So too, for that matter, did some large number of ordinary Irish citizens who bought houses for fantastic sums. Ireland's 87% rate of home ownership is the highest in the world. There's no such thing as a non-recourse mortgage in Ireland. The guy who pays too much for his house is not allowed simply to hand the keys to the bank and walk away. He's on the hook, personally, for whatever he borrowed. Across Ireland, people are unable to extract themselves from their houses or their bank loans. Irish people will tell you that because of their sad history of dispossession, owning a home is not just a way to avoid paying rent, but a mark of freedom. In their rush to freedom, the Irish built their own prisons, and their leaders helped them to do it. Just before the closing bell, the two men who sold the Irish people on the notion that they were responsible not merely for their own disastrous financial decisions, but also for the ones made by their banks, arrive in the chamber. Prime Minister Brian Cowan and Finance Minister Brian Lenehan, along with the leader of the opposition and the third in command of their own party, both are children of politicians who died in office. Irish politics is a family affair. Cowan happens also to have been the Minister of Finance from 2004 until mid-2008, when most of the bad stuff happened. He is not an obvious leader of men. His movements are sullen and lumbering, his face numbed by corpulence, his natural resting expression a look of confusion. One morning a few weeks before, he went on national radio sounding to well-trained Irish ears drunk. To my less trained ones, he sounded merely groggy, but the public is in no mood to cut him a break. Four different Irish people told me on great authority that Cowan had faxed Ireland's €440 billion bank guarantee into the European Central Bank from a pub. And the truth is, if you were to design a human being to maximize the likelihood that people would assume he drank too much, you'd have a hard time doing better than the Irish Prime Minister. Brian Lenehan, who follows on Cowan's bovine heels, comes across by comparison as a decathlete in peak condition. On this day, incredibly yet predictably, the Parliament decides not to hold a vote to fill three of its four empty seats. Then they adjourn, and I spend an hour with Joan Burton. Of the major parties in Ireland, Labour offers the closest thing to a dissenting opinion and a critique of Irish capitalism. As one of only 18 members of the Irish House of Commons who voted against guaranteeing the bank's debts, Burton retains rare credibility. And in an hour of chatting about this and that, she strikes me as straight, bright, and basically good news. But her role in the Irish drama is as clear as Morgan Kelly's. She's the shrill mother no one listened to. She speaks in exclamation points with a whiny voice that gets on the nerves of every Irishman, to the point where her voice is parodied on national radio. Now, when I ask her what she would do differently from what the Irish government is doing, even she is stumped. Like every other Irish politician, she is at the mercy of forces beyond her control. The Irish bank debt is now Irish government debt, and any suggestion of default will only raise the cost of borrowing the foreign money they now can't live without. "Do you know that Irish people are now experts on bonds?" says Burton. "Yes, they now say 100 basis points rather than 1%. They have developed a new vocabulary." As the scope of the Irish losses has grown clearer, private investors have been less and less willing to leave even overnight deposits in Irish banks and completely uninterested in buying longer-term bank bonds. The European Central Bank has quietly filled the void. One of the most closely watched numbers in Europe has been the amount the ECB has loaned to the big Irish banks. In late 2007, with the markets still suspending their disbelief, the banks had borrowed €6.5 billion. By December of 2008, the number had jumped to €45 billion. As Burton spoke to me, the number was rising from around 86 billion to a fresh high of 97 billion. That is, from November 2007 to October 2010, the Irish banks have borrowed 97 billion euros from the European Central Bank to repay private creditors. In September 2010, the last big chunk of money the Irish banks owed to their bondholders, 26 billion euros, came due. Once the bondholders were paid off in full, a window of opportunity for the Irish government closed. A default of the banks would now not be a default to private investors, but a bill presented directly to European governments. This, by the way, is why there are so many important-looking foreigners in Dublin dining alone at night. They're here to make sure someone gets his money back. One measure of how completely the Irish can't imagine offending their foreign financial rulers is how quickly Burton declines to contemplate such a default. She bears no responsibility at all for the bank's private debts, and yet when we creep up on the possibility of simply walking away from them, she veers away. Actually, she ups and leaves. "Oh, I have to go," she says. "I have to meet the finance minister with the bad news." Lenihan has called a private meeting with the opposition so that its leaders will be the first to hear of the draconian new Irish budget. This meeting is held not inside the parliament, where the media can be kept at arm's length, but in a nearby building where the media are allowed to congregate. "We tried to have it in here, but he moved it outside," says Burton. "He's taken to bringing us in to tell us the bad news first, so that when we walk out, we're the ones announcing it to the media." She smiles. "He's tricky that way." Brian Lenihan is the last remaining Irish politician anywhere near power whose mere appearance does not cause people on the streets of Dublin to explode with either scorn or laughter. He came to the job just weeks before the crisis and so escapes blame for its origins. He's a barrister, not a financial or real estate person, with a proven ability to earn a good living without being bribed by property developers. He comes from a family of political people who are thought to have served honorably, or at any rate not used politics to enrich themselves. And in December 2009, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Anyone who has been anywhere near an Irish Catholic family knows that the member who has had the most recent run of bad luck enjoys exalted status, the right to do pretty much whatever he wants to do while everyone else squirms in silence. Since news of Lenihan's illness broke, just days after he'd learned of it himself, apparently, and before he'd told his children, he's minimized his suffering, running under the public opinion polls that show the Irish feel a lot better about the Minister of Finance than they do about other politicians in his party, is a common, unspoken understanding of his bravery. Brian Lenihan is also, as Joan Burton pointed out, tricky. "It's racing up on 8 in the evening when I meet him in a Department of Finance conference room. He spent most of his day defending the harshest spending cuts and tax hikes in Irish history to Irish politicians, without offering any details about who, exactly, will pay for the bank's losses. He's waiting until after the single by-election that the Doyle authorized is held." He smiles. "Why is everyone so interested in Ireland?" he asks, almost innocently. "There's really far too much interest in us right now." "Because you're interesting," I say. "Oh no," he says seriously. "We're not, really." He proceeds to make the collapse of the Irish economy as uninteresting as possible. This awkward social responsibility, normalizing a freak show, is now a meaningful part of the job of being Ireland's finance minister. At just the moment the crazy uncle leapt from the cellar, the drunken aunt lurched through the front door, and in front of the entire family and many important guests, they carved each other to bits with hunting knives. Daddy must now reassure eyewitnesses that they didn't see what they think they saw. But the evidence that something deeply weird just happened in Ireland is still too conspicuous. A mile from the conference table where we take our seats, you can still find a moonscape of vast 2-year-old craters from which office parks were once meant to rise. Fully finished skyscrapers sit empty, water pooling on their lobby floors. There's a skeleton of a tower, cranes at rest on either side, like parentheses. It was meant to house Anglo-Irish Bank. There's an empty new conference center that cost 75 million euros to build that has never been hooked up to the Dublin sewer and water systems. There's a city dump for which a developer paid 412 million euros in 2006, and which is now, when you include the cleanup costs, valued at negative 30 million euros. Ireland is very unusual, says William Newsom, who has 40 years of experience valuing commercial real estate for Savills in London. There are whole swaths of either undeveloped land with planning permission, or even partially developed sites, which for practical purposes have zero value. The peak of the Irish madness is frozen in time for all to see. There's even an empty Starbucks in the heart of what was meant to be a global financial center to rival London, where a carton of low-fat milk curdles beside a silver barista pitcher. The finance minister might as well be standing in front of Pompeii and saying that the volcano wasn't really worth mentioning, just a little lava. "This isn't Iceland," is what he actually says. "We're not a hedge fund that's populated by 300,000 farmers and fishermen. Ireland is not going back to the 80s or the 90s. This is all in a much narrower band." And then he goes off on a soliloquy, the main point of which is, "Ireland's problems are solvable, and I am in control of the situation." Back in September 2008, however, there was evidence that he wasn't. On September 17, the financial markets were in turmoil. Lehman Brothers had failed 2 days earlier, and the shares of Irish banks were plummeting and big corporations were withdrawing their deposits from them. Late that night, Lenihan phoned David McWilliams, a former research analyst with UBS in Zurich in London, who had moved back home to Dublin and turned himself into a writer and media personality. McWilliams had been loudly skeptical about the Irish real estate boom. 2 weeks earlier, he had appeared on a television show with Lenihan. Lenihan had seemed to him entirely untroubled by the turmoil in the financial markets. Now he wanted to drive out and ask McWilliams' advice on what to do about the Irish banks. The peculiar scene appears in McWilliams' charmingly indiscreet book, Follow the Money. Lenihan arrives at the McWilliams residence, a 45-minute drive outside of Dublin, marches through to the family kitchen, and pulls a hunk of raw garlic out of his jacket pocket. He kicked off by saying, "If his officials knew he was here in my house, there'd be war," writes McWilliams. The finance minister stayed until 2 in the morning. Peeling cloves of raw garlic and eating them, and anxiously picking McWilliams' brain. McWilliams came away with the feeling that the minister didn't entirely trust the advice he was getting from the people around him, and that he was not merely worried, but confused. McWilliams told me that he sensed the mental state of the finance ministry was complete chaos. A week later, the Irish finance ministry hired investment bankers from Merrill Lynch to advise them. Some might say that if you were asking Merrill Lynch for financial advice in 2008, you were already in trouble, but that is not entirely fair. The bank analyst who had been most prescient and interesting about the Irish banks worked for Merrill Lynch. His name was Philip Ingram. In his late 20s and a bit quirky, at Cambridge University, he had prepared for a career in zoology. Ingram had done something original and useful. He'd shined a new light on the way Irish banks lent against commercial real estate. The commercial real estate loan market is generally less transparent than the market for home loans. The deals between bankers and property developers are one-off, on terms unknown to all but a few insiders. The parties to any loan always claim it is prudent. A bank analyst has little choice but to take them at their word. But Ingram was skeptical of the Irish banks. He had read Morgan Kelly's newspaper articles and even paid Kelly a visit in his University College office. To Ingram's eyes, there appeared to be a vast difference between what the Irish banks were saying and what they were doing. To get at it, he ignored what they were saying and went looking for knowledgeable insiders in the commercial property market. He interviewed them as a journalist might. On March 13, 2008, 6 months before the Irish real estate Ponzi scheme collapsed, Ingram published a report in which he simply quoted, verbatim, what market insiders had told him about various banks lending to commercial real estate developers. The Irish banks were making far riskier loans in Ireland than they were in Britain. But even in Britain, the report revealed, they were the nuttiest lenders around. In that category, Anglo-Irish, Bank of Ireland, and AIB came in that order, first, second, and third. For a few hours, the Merrill Lynch report was the hottest read in the London financial markets, until Merrill Lynch retracted it. Merrill was the lead underwriter of Anglo-Irish's bonds and the corporate broker to AIB. They'd earned huge sums of money off the growth of Irish banking. Moments after Phil Ingram hit the send button on his report, the banks called their Merrill Lynch bankers and threatened to take their business elsewhere. The same executive from Anglo-Irish Bank, who had called to scream at Morgan Kelly, called a Merrill research analyst to scream some more. "I thought your work was fucking shit." Ingram's superiors at Merrill Lynch hauled him into meetings with in-house lawyers who rewrote his report, purging it of its pointed language and its damning quotes from market insiders, including their many references to Irish banks. Ingram's immediate boss in the research department, a fellow named Ed Alchin, was made to apologize to Merrill's investment bankers individually for the trouble he had caused them. And from that moment, everything Ingram wrote about Irish banks was rewritten and bolderized by Merrill Lynch's lawyers. At the end of 2008, Merrill fired him. It would have been difficult for Merrill Lynch's investment bankers not to know on some level that in a reckless market, the Irish banks acted with a recklessness all their own. But in the 6-page memo to Brian Lenihan, for which the Irish taxpayer forked over to Merrill Lynch 7 million euros, they kept whatever reservations they might have had to themselves. "All of the Irish banks are profitable and well-capitalized," wrote the Merrill Lynch advisors, and then went on to suggest that their problem wasn't at all the bad loans they had made, but the panic in the market. The Merrill Lynch memo listed a number of possible responses the Irish government might have to any run on Irish banks. It refrained from explicitly recommending one course of action over another, but its analysis of the problem implied that the most sensible thing to do was to guarantee the banks. After all, the banks were fundamentally sound. Promise to eat all losses, and markets would quickly settle down, and the Irish banks would go back to being in perfectly good shape. As there would be no losses, the promise would be free. What exactly was said in the meeting on the night of September 29, 2008 remains, amazingly, something of a secret. The government has refused Freedom of Information Act requests for the notes taken by participants. Apart from the Prime Minister and the bank regulators, the only people at the conference table inside the Ministry of Finance were the heads of the two yet-to-be-disgraced big Irish banks, AIB and Bank of Ireland. Evidently, they either lied to Brian Lenihan about the extent of their losses or didn't know themselves what those were, or both. At the time, they were all saying the same thing, an Irish bank analyst tells me. "We don't have any subprime." What they meant was that they had avoided lending to American subprime borrowers. What they neglected to mention was that in the general frenzy, all of Ireland had become subprime. Otherwise sound Irish borrowers had been rendered unsound by the size of the loans they had taken out to buy inflated Irish property. That had been the strangest consequence of the Irish bubble. To throw a nation that had finally clawed its way out of centuries of indentured servitude back into indentured servitude. The report from Merrill Lynch asserting that the banks were fundamentally sound buttressed whatever story the banks told the finance minister. The Irish government's bank regulator, Patrick Neary, had echoed Merrill's judgment. Morgan Kelly was still a zany egghead. At any rate, no one who took him seriously was present in the room. Anglo-Irish's stock had fallen 46% that day. AIB's had fallen 15%. There was a fair chance that when the stock exchange reopened, one or both of them would go out of business. In the general panic, absent government intervention, the other banks would have gone down with Anglo-Irish. Lenehan faced a choice. Should he believe the people immediately around him or the financial markets? Should he trust the family or the experts? He stuck with the family. Ireland gave its promise, and the promise sank Ireland. Even at the time, the decision seemed a bit odd. The Irish banks, like the big American banks, managed to persuade a lot of people that they were so intertwined with their economy that their failure would bring down a lot of other things too. But they weren't, at least not all of them. Anglo-Irish Bank had only 6 branches, no ATMs, and no organic relationship with Irish business except the property developers. It lent money to people to buy land and build. That's all it did. It did this with money it had borrowed from foreigners. It was not, by nature, systemic. It became so only when its losses were made everyone's. In any case, if the Irish wanted to save their banks, why not guarantee just the deposits? There's a big difference between depositors and bondholders. Depositors can flee. The immediate danger to the banks was that savers who had put money into them would take their money out and the banks would be without funds. The investors who own the roughly 80 billion euros worth of Irish bank bonds, on the other hand, were stuck. They couldn't take their money out of the bank, and their 80 billion euros very nearly exactly covered the eventual losses inside the Irish banks. These private bondholders didn't have any right to be made whole by the Irish government. The bondholders didn't even expect to be made whole by the Irish government. Not long ago, I spoke with a former senior Merrill Lynch bond trader who on September 29, 2008, owned a pile of bonds in one of the Irish banks. He'd already tried to sell them back to the bank for 50 cents on the dollar. That is, he'd offered to take a huge loss just to get out of them. On the morning of September 30, he awakened to find his bonds worth 100 cents on the dollar. The Irish government had guaranteed them. He couldn't believe his luck. Across the financial markets, this episode repeated itself. People who had made a private bet that had gone wrong and didn't expect to be repaid in full were handed their money back from the Irish taxpayer. In retrospect, now that the Irish bank losses are known to be world historically huge, the decision to cover them appears not merely odd, but suicidal. A handful of Irish bankers incurred debts they could never repay of something like 100 billion euros. They may have had no idea what they were doing, but they did it all the same. Their debts were private, owed by them to investors around the world. And still the Irish people have undertaken to repay them as if they were obligations of the state. For 2 years they have labored under this impossible burden with scarcely a peep of protest. What's more, all of the policy decisions since September 29, 2008 have set the hook more firmly inside the mouths of the Irish public. In January 2009, the Irish government nationalized Anglo-Irish and its losses of 34 billion euros and mounting. In late 2009, They created the National Asset Management Agency, the Irish version of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, but unlike the U.S. government, actually followed through and bought 80 billion euros worth of crappy assets from the Irish banks. A single decision sank Ireland, but when I ask Lenihan about it, he becomes impatient, as if it isn't a fit topic for conversation. It wasn't much of a decision, he says, as he had no choice. Irish financial market rules are patterned on English law, and under English law, the bondholders enjoy the same status as the ordinary depositors. That is, it was against the law to protect the little people with deposits in the bank without also saving the big investors who owned Irish bank bonds. This rings a bell. When U.S. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson realized that allowing Lehman Brothers to fail was viewed not as brave and principled, but catastrophic, he too claimed he'd done what he'd done because the law gave him no other option. In the heat of the crisis, Paulson neglected to mention the law, just as Lenihan didn't bring up the law requiring him to pay off the bank's private lenders until long after he'd done it. In both cases, the explanation was legalistic, narrowly true, but generally false. The Irish government